Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Stephen Rood, the Asia Foundation's country representative for the Philippines and regional advisor for local governance, where he helps to build local government, decentralization, and municipal government programs throughout the region. Before joining the Asia Foundation, he served as a professor of political science at the University of the Philippines. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Rood. Stephen? Hello.
Thank you for having me. Hello?
Yes. Thank you for joining us, Stephen, from Manila. Now, there's some confusion over the basic facts of what's happened here in terms of casualties and people who've been displaced. President Aquino has said that it was only 2,000 dead, or maybe 2,500. Initial estimates were 10,000 dead. Now the United Nations, citing Philippine government figures, are putting the death toll at 4,460, with nearly a million people displaced. So what's the latest from where you sit?
Well, I think the fact of the matter is that the UN agencies are most up to date on that. The president's interview was a couple of days ago, and the death tolls continue to rise as new outlying areas have been reached. The original number of 10,000 came from a shell-shocked police chief who was just wandering around Tacloban, where most of his men had disappeared, and saw bodies all over, and that's where he came up with that guesstimate. But now these numbers are unfortunately very high and probably will continue to rise.
And what is the sense then of how this is being handled? The president has come under criticism for bottlenecks and he's had to defend the response. The U.S. Aircraft carrier, the George Washington, apparently is in there delivering aid. What do you hear from what's happening in Lady Providence?
Well, the government has admitted to lapses. They, by their own data, for instance, they're only reaching at yesterday about half of the people who need emergency food assistance, and so they continue to try to set up new logistics centers and get the food aid down and repacked and so on. I heard a Oxfam logistics specialist say that he was involved in the Katrina rescue, and 7 days after Katrina, there were still places that hadn't been reached, and that's in one of the world's most rich countries, and here comes a storm that's three times as hard. And so in perspective, it's probably, okay. But in perspective of the people who desperately need this assistance, of course there's lapses. Of course they need to move faster. There's a lot of different, Malaysia, Taiwan, Korea, French, Belgium. There's a lot of international resources coming in and coordinating with the national government.
Well, now that you've brought it up, Stephen Rood, in terms of international response, I have to mention that China initially donated a paltry $100,000, and apparently they bumped this number up to $1.4 million, which is still pretty pathetic.
There's obviously geopolitical considerations, both in the initial response because of the disputes over the West Philippine or South China Sea, and in the need to bump it up in order to play in the same game as the other donors.
Again, I'm speaking with Stephen Rood, who's the Asia Foundation's country representative for the Philippines and regional advisor for local governance, where he helps to build local government, decentralization, and municipal government programs throughout the region. Before joining the Asia Foundation, he served as a professor of political science at the University of the Philippines, and he's talking to us from Manila. Now, people I've talked to over the last few days have brought up both Filipinos and also scholars of the Philippines have over here have brought up the endemic corruption, which is one of the reasons why the infrastructure is inadequate to begin with, and now, of course, in Lady Province, it's all but been destroyed. What is the story here in terms of political dynasties, of local political dynasties? Is it as oligarchical as I've been led to believe?
Well, the Philippine society in general organizes itself along families, and so it's not surprising that politics is organized among families instead of political parties, for instance. And the transaction in politics is very concrete. Characteristic that Filipinos want of their elected officials is that they're approachable. Not that they're intelligent, not that they're honest, but that they're approachable, because in that way they can approach them in need. And so there's this transaction of very concrete benefits that goes on. Often those transactions need to be either diversion of government projects from one place to another, or actual diversion of funds away so that the politician has the resources to respond to these immediate needs for schooling, for medicine, for whatever, when his constituents arrive at his doorstep. There's been two effects of this on infrastructure, as you mentioned. One is that there's not enough tax increase to a tax take to fund enough infrastructure, so there's a general lack. And then while an infrastructure project might be ongoing, if funds are diverted away from it, then it will be substandard and more likely to be damaged. Over the past 3 to 4 years, there's been an improvement in that in the Department of Public Works in driving down corruption by about, at least driving down the wastage by 15 or 20%. We don't know the absolute level of corruption anymore. This is a decades-old problem, and just 2 or 3 years of improvement is not going to solve it.
And how long can Aquino blame corruption on his predecessor? Because I understand there's some scandals going on now.
Well, that's an interesting question. The original scandal, the big scandal, which was supposedly about pork barrel spending, that is discretionary spending by congressmen that got with funds diverted to middlemen, that all happened under his predecessor, Gloria Macapagal-Arroyo. But those accused in the legislature have managed to include in the story the executive branch's discretionary movement of funds from projects with savings over to new projects that could be dispersed to get new roads built or continue the economic growth and so on. And the claim is that that is unconstitutional because it is not pursuant to a budget of Congress. And so, indeed, the president has been lumped into this whole discourse of discretionary spending. He's tried to seize the initiative by going on TV and saying, "I am not a crook,"
that worked for Nixon, right?
Exactly. Then many people immediately picked it up. Just because he said it in Tagalog doesn't mean that it doesn't sound like Richard Nixon. So he could, in this instance, he could, if this, in the next couple of weeks, process of relief turns into a transparent, effective, widespread meeting of the needs of the people, he could regain control of the narrative, which is he's the anti-corruption president. On the other hand, if the lapses continue, there's definitely a possible downside.
So just in the last couple of minutes then, Stephen Rood, we hear reports of bodies still lying in the street and people, thousands injured at the local hospitals where they're operating without anesthetic, without medicine, and with candlelight.
Yes, this is absolutely true. I mean, this is you can obviously see it. The thing about the bodies actually is interesting. The technicians, you know, the technical people say there's not a public health risk for bodies. I mean, they're not contagious. So, you know, when the president says we're trying to take care of the living, what he's saying is we're trying to get food to the 50,000 families that need the food, rather than to worry about that. Secondly, there is a delay because they have now started to insist on identifying the bodies before burying them, whereas in previous disasters, often they were buried in mass graves, and so people didn't know what happened. So that has really slowed things down, but this hasn't been you know, explain to people, and so they still see these very distressing images of people there. I was in the 1990 Baguio earthquake, the mountain city up in north, and we were cut off from every place for about 2 weeks, except for one very small airport. And things get really desperate because there's not that much stock of medicines in a town. There's not that much stock of gasoline in a town. So the very basics need to be prioritized getting there.
Well, Stephen Rood, I thank you for joining us. I take it you've got some people on your staff who've been traumatized by the events as well, right?
Well, I have one staffer who went down to find his family, found his family. The house is destroyed, but the family was okay. And the thing is, it's the children who really are traumatized because, you know, they go, as he brings them back to Manila, where it's, you know, relatively peaceful and safe and so on, you know, they have to go through these areas which are devastated and to see the bodies. So psychosocial counseling of people is going to be crucial because we have, you know, as you say, hundreds of thousands of people who've been through this and they've, you know, had days and days of trauma, and they really are going to need help even after they're getting food, water, and shelter. They're going to need a lot of help in terms of psychosocial counseling.
Well, Stephen Rood, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Stephen Rood, who's in the Philippines. He's the Asia Foundation's country representative for the Philippines and regional advisor for local governance, where he helps to build local government, decentralization, and municipal government programs throughout the region. Before joining the Asia Foundation, he served as a professor of political science at the University of the Philippines. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back and take a look inside the Ayatollah's democracy.